We know the drill.
We actually, we have our own show. So.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But thank you.
So thanks.
Really appreciate it.
So no need then. Great.
We have much shittier microphones also.
Oh, boy. We're good.
We are burning down the house here every Thursday evening on the Heritage Radio Network. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe, www.techserve.com.
This evening's topic is generally about architectural education. We have joining us here in studio, Eric Moed and Brian Schulman, both students.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
At the Pratt Institute here in beautiful Brooklyn. The sub-theme is passions, obsessions, and ideas, because one of my favorite sayings is from Eero Saarinen, who once remarked that while all the world runs in rabbit time, architecture runs in elephant time. And by what he meant to convey is not only is the creation of architecture a very lengthy process, but architects live to grand old ages, and in fact, the ideas and obsessions that we have as young students, and perhaps even more early than that, take decades until we are in a position to carry them out into built form. One of the other sub-themes of tonight's program will be the aspect of what we listen to in studio. And before we get into our first segment of discussion and conversation, let's play some music that these fine young fellows, I was going to say cannibals, but I don't. You don't look like you're that meat-eating.
Very skinny.
Yeah, like to listen to as they're working through their architectural studies.
Turn me.
we been hearing here, fellas?
This is Radiohead, thankfully. Definitely one of the most listened to bands in the student world of architecture.
Yes.
And I think both Brian and I could go for the entire hour or so talking about just this.
About Radiohead?
Yes. About Radiohead alone.
Well, let's make radio instead.
I like
Are there
that.
Any particular lyrics from this song that are particularly redolent or vibrant for you?
Well, there's a song by Radiohead called Everything in Its Right Place, and I've found that that theme has come up many, many times in my my studies and views of architecture.
Excellent.
And things like that.
Well, that's a perfect hook for what we're going to start out with. We're going to pretend that this is Jeopardy, and it's architectural quotes for, where do they start, with $100 now?
Sure.
Something like that. Anyway, let's test your knowledge of famous architectural aphorisms.
Pop quiz.
Because one aspect of a really fully formed architectural education is knowing these favorite quotes. Why? Because inevitably, one of your smarty-ass clients is going to pull one of these chestnuts out of the air and test whether you actually are a fully educated architect. So we'll start with some softball ones here. And to make it easy for you, I will speak these in the proper dialect. A house is a machine for living in.
Le Corbusier.
Very good. He also said, architecture is the learned game, correct and magnificent of forms assembled in the light. Isn't that nice?
Beautiful.
That's fabulous. All right. Perhaps a little more difficult here. Architecture starts when you carefully put two bricks together. There it begins.
This is Gropius?
Close. He also said, God is in the details.
Oh, Mies, of course.
Of course.
He also said,
Mr. van der Rohe.
Mies, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. He also said, I don't want to be interesting. I want to be good.
Good, yeah, that's
Excellent.
Right.
Excellent. You guys
one.
Are doing well.
It's written on the inside of my sketchbook.
Excellent. Also, perhaps his most famous, less is more, which for Mies, with the stripped down, his own version of Friedrich Schinkel, that's an angle that is not widely thought of, but I heard that from Philip Johnson, who knew Mies very, very well. Next, the physician can bury his mistakes, but the architect can only advise his clients to plant ivy.
This is Aldo Rossi?
No, this is Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright. Way off.
Thanks.
I call architecture frozen music.
Oh, that's Libeskind.
No, sorry. That's Johann Wolfgang von Goethe.
Probably
Daniel Libeskind may, you know, have
Sounds like Libeskind.
Tried to adopt that himself.
Yeah.
Although in the case of Libeskind, you have to wonder what kind of frozen music we're looking at. Mm. The jaggy icicle sort of acid rock of his youth, perhaps. Form follows function.
We should know this.
We should know this. That's
Louis Sullivan.
Oh, Sullivan, yeah.
Quoting Horatio Greeno, who was a very well-known mid-19th century sculptor in the United States. Now we're getting into the esoteric. To me, the drawn language is a very revealing language. One can see in a few lines whether a man is really an architect. He also said, always design a thing by considering its next larger context. Now, this is really an interesting quote. A chair in a room in a house in an environment, and an environment in a city plan.
Is it Van Eyck?
No, but if you think of the movie, you know the famous movie, The Powers of Ten. Have you seen that?
Yes.
By Eames.
Yes.
Below your mind.
Eames' best friend, who also said, as I said before, the world runs in rabbit time, architecture in elephant time, Eros Saarinen. This is a really good one. I hate vacations. If you can build buildings, why sit on the beach? Philip Johnson. Architecture begins where engineering ends. Walter Gropius. Two more.
Shouldn't it be the other way around? Engineering begins where architecture ends?
It depends if you're Salvatore Calatrava. who's, to my mind, actually a fabulous sculptor. I don't know if he's really
an architect.
Such an architect.
Well, yeah. If you heard about his project in Jerusalem right now, you probably would definitely be saying that statement you just said, because they designed a bridge for a train without really trying to think of how much the train itself would weigh. So when they ordered the cars for the trains,
they have to go one car at a time?
No, they have to literally rework the entire bridge now.
Oh, details, details. This is a really good one. I love this next to last quotation. When I'm working on a problem, and he was the fellow who came up with this one always spoke very quickly. When I'm working on a problem, I never think about beauty. But when I have finished it, if the solution is not beautiful, I know it's wrong. Bucky Fuller. And one that my very good friend of the show, will absolutely detest. If you listen to the first show, you'll know why. Architecture is inhabited sculpture. That's Constantine Brancusi, the bird in flight guy. Mm. Now, this is indicative of these different attitudes towards design. And I think, especially what Saarinen had to say about a chair in a room in a house in a village, and the village in a city. It's increasing increments of scale, but also it's all contextual, which is pretty funny for the guy who designed the TWA pavilion terminal at JFK, because it's totally acontextual. Yeah, it sort of is symbolic of birds or seagulls that litter all the runways over there, but it's totally
Arch in St. Louis. But the Arch, yeah, it could have been built at any scale, really,
and it could be anywhere. There's nothing particularly that when you see that you say, "Oh yes, this is the gateway to the West."
Well, it just happens. It's been to be made there. Into that symbol. Over
I think
time,
that was
in, based on its.
I think it was. I think it was his original intention. But then, on the other hand, Gaudi, had he lived longer, not been run over by a streetcar, he might have designed that same arch, because his work was all catenary forms. Absolutely. Made by draping cloth dipped in plaster of Paris.
Sure. I was just in Barcelona myself and was privileged enough to have witnessed all that stuff. Unbelievable to see a church still in construction after however many decades.
Well, St. John the Divine is still under construction too, but it's a totally different experience.
Unless there was a fire.
Well, yes, but... that's one of our guest interlocutors. That's Allison Wayne over there in the wings. Hi, Allison. That happens to be my daughter. And we also have Jamie Waugh, who's a writer for Dwell Magazine, sitting in.
Hello.
And if you feel that you want to put your two cents in, please do, because this is a conversation. Let's take another brief break and come back to talking about the music, your ideas, and your obsessions.
So, Curtis.
Hello.
Eric, Brian, what are we listening to here?
This is Dr. Dog.
Dr. Dog.
Yes.
D-A-W-G?
Philadelphia.
No, D-O-G. It's classic as it sounds, as Brian said, straight out of Philadelphia. And this, I guess, represents the other side of the music that we listen to, being that Radiohead was actually one of the first bands that I heard of, which would bring laptops on stage with them. And that was really surprising to me back when I first started listening to them. Dr. Dog really reminds us, I guess, of, as you were saying, the scale of how everything is related to the city. Even if you're in the countryside, you're leaving the city and you're leaving your roots and your thoughts.
Sounds terribly alienated, however. Of course, Philadelphia, from a New Yorker's point of view, is an alien culture. Everyone has cars, for example. Even people who live in
suburbs,
the inner city of Philadelphia.
Yeah. Well, if Lou Kahn had his way, that wouldn't be the case.
Explain.
Well, he had a whole proposal where he essentially wanted to, I wouldn't say wall off, but basically not allow traffic into the central part of the city. So everyone would be biking around and walking around and park their cars outside of the city itself.
To a certain extent, that does happen. You park, you walk up those steps, you know, where the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Rocky running up and down the steps thing there at the big neoclassical museum near the...
Who wants to walk everywhere in a city?
Well, that's why Segways were invented, right?
Oh, right. Oh, they really revolutionized things, right? Yeah.
I think they're illegal in New York, you know. You're not allowed to run them on the street because they're not a motor vehicle. And
legal inside malls only.
Yeah.
Mall cops. It's
such a crazy thing.
I saw like a whole crap load of tourists in D.C. Like
on Segways?
Yeah.
Oh, how pathetic.
See the city at a snail's pace.
What are those things called again? Because you don't ever see them in New York, so...
Man.
But they're, they're probably a good idea, except it just strikes me as a little bit indulgent that you just lean and you just take your blobby self all over the streets.
Well, what happens when somebody invents a mode of transportation that moves at an entirely different pace from what the entire city was designed and
that's a very good
grew
point.
Into?
Well, I mean, they're
make a Segway lane? Come on, like no one's going to...
Well, hey, they're designing cars that essentially park themselves, that if you're veering off the road and falling asleep...
You've seen the Mercedes ad, too.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's a great idea. And eventually there will be some sort of accommodation for cars to be able to platoon to follow each other very closely at high speed.
But then the entire city's going to have to be redesigned, all the roads and...
Well, it'll start with the interstates, I think. You know, those interstates where you're going like 95 miles an hour anyway, basically... You know, through GPS and sensors and so on and so forth. And I say so on and so forth because I don't know the technical details, obviously. If I did, I probably wouldn't be here. I think that cars would be moving excruciatingly fast.
That was Corbu's dream, right, for his endless city. Cars would go 190 miles an hour between massive building projects.
Well, I have read that the interstates were designed for 90 mile an hour traffic. The problem is that...
There's police on them?
No. In years,
people drink and drive.
In years since, they haven't been maintained.
And that there's tolls.
And also, many of our highways are not banked correctly for that speed of travel.
Make a slight turn and
I have a very good friend from Zurich who came over and he tried driving really fast on one of our interstates and he almost lost control and he said, "Can I just..." The interstate highways are not banked properly. I lost control of my Dodge. I said, "Yeah, well, you know, it's not the Autobahn, man." But that's interesting. There are architectural designs through history and even still today with the Hadid woman who claims that her designs are evocative of motion and of automotive fortes. What do people think about things like that?
So, I mean, if you look at her drawings and things like that and some of the renderings, it kind of makes you think, does she think that people are going to be tumbling over or propelling themselves through these buildings? Are you sort of rocketing through?
Are you supposed to get a thrill just
it's a building
sitting
a,
still while the building's going woo all around you?
I mean, I've never been into one of her buildings. And I would love to, but...
I don't know that she's actually successfully carried out very many of those yet, which is a problem with being a predominantly paper architect.
Right.
Well, one thing she did do was the interior of a Chanel handbag.
I saw that. I was privileged enough.
That's the architecture of handbags. That's well, a great diversity.
All about scale, right? We just said that.
Yeah, but you know, she walks a fine line. I mean, she's, I guess you could say, an artist first and an architect second, and she would hate to hear that, obviously. But hey, anyway, basically, she gave a talk at Pratt, and as you mentioned, that's where Brian and I go. And she couldn't talk about her work. I was thoroughly disappointed. I enjoy looking at it.
How very strange.
She was like, this is in Zurich. This is in Paris. She couldn't say anything else about it. It was unbelievable to me. I could
talk
for days.
It's all about those drawings.
What's her name again?
Zahia Hadid. Z-A-H-I-A.
She's Iraqi, right?
Zaha. Z-A-H-A.
Zaha. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
From our writer over here.
Thank you.
Is she Iraqi? Or where is she?
You'll have to Google.
Good.
She's Iranian. She's Persian.
Iranian.
Ah, Persian. It's the high culture of the Middle East.
Mm.
How interesting. Well, as you're studying architecture and as you're working through your assignments, all of this stuff that's in the environment, the intellectual environment, but it sounds like, in this case, it's certainly not an idea-driven impression that you got from this one particular designer. I'm sure that you have some teachers, and you read that there would be ideas that capture your imagination. Yes,
I would say so. Yeah,
and what might those be?
What ideas from contemporary architects?
What ideas grab you? I don't want to impose my own. I don't want to give you a leading question like, well, don't you think that the whole idea of having a photovoltaic facade is just really fabulous? I'd like to hear from you what things are, you know, really getting to you.
Well, I think Eric and I we look at a lot of architecture, and we travel a lot throughout the city and explore.
And that's a good thing.
And I think what we've really find captivating is the older infrastructure and how it's crumbling, or just buildings that have been around for, you know, 100 years and this, you know, families still live in them, things like that.
Well, a 100-year-old building really shouldn't be crumbling. The ones that you see crumbling are probably 160 years old, and they were probably built as tenements and not particularly well built in the first place.
And those things are really juxtaposed by brand new
shoddy
paper thin, you know, condos by, you know, random developers who think that,
but
worse
honestly,
than that, just like local dudes who just build these things and
whatever the cheapest material is, they just throw
it
up there.
It's strange to see that these things, and you don't feel that these newer buildings are gonna last, and they don't, because they looked like they were just like, well,
for example,
I don't know.
For example, walk around Fort Greene.
Yeah, like
walk around Fort Greene and look around at all the new construction. It's been around for, what, 2 years? There's streaks on all the glass, streaks on all the quote-unquote metallic stuff in it.
Well, that's a maintenance issue.
I mean, you look at a brick building with, you know, some heavy glass windows, and just looks probably the same, maybe a little dustier than it did 50 years earlier.
So do you enjoy that? That contextual frisson?
It's very interesting to see all these things just up against each other. And
now, do you take the time to either photograph or sketch older things?
I personally have many, many photographs, and call me old school, but I do like walking around the neighborhood taking pictures. I enjoy it.
I don't know that that's so old school.
Well,
I'd say sketching is even more old school.
Watercolor.
Fair enough. But I mean, it's very interesting in school now, because it is a very romantic notion about the notion of the permanence of a building and something that you could personally create will be there for a century, and a half.
Let's consider an acculturated, that's one of Peter Eisenman's favorite words, an acculturated response to permanence. You come to associate masonry construction with permanence, whereas a glass tower might well last for 250 years if it's maintained.
I think what really just strikes me is that we have the power to create something that can just be around for hundreds of years.
If you know
at least
what you're doing.
If we want, yeah, at least.
You can do a shabby job and it will last for a good 75 years.
Well, that too is pretty exciting.
In which case it'll burn in a second. My whole job is like insuring buildings. Oh, well. So when my dad's like, you know, masonry is going to last, you know, 100 years. I'm like, yeah, masonry is going to last 100 years until like someone like the Dwayne Reed next door has an electrical fire and then it's gone.
Well,
so.
Yeah, I think it's not even that it's about the
everything's
the material.
Ephemeral. It doesn't even matter.
Well, well yeah, forget about
the attitude.
Unless you have, you know, sprinklers like every
well,
2 feet.
I mean, so. I think we have to backtrack here because we're talking about masonry. Meanwhile, Brian and I are in school looking at models that are made out of paper. And it's very conflicting kind of thing to be in school now, as I'm sure, Curtis, we've talked about previously because, you know, I work in the same office as Curtis. And basically, it's unbelievable to see that some or most professors these days that are younger ignore structure. They just ignore it straight up. It's well, unbelievable.
It's all about making a drawing, making a model, 3D.
You're just making something that looks pretty.
Well, that's just a new iteration on being a paper architect, which is a phenomenon I know fully well, having spent 5 years with John Hiddick, who is almost entirely a producer of works of paper architecture. Now, Jamie, you had a question for them that came up during the break.
Well, actually, I have another question related to what we're talking about now, which is a question about craft, actually. And I know there's a lot of skepticism in the country about what an architect does and whether it's actually a valuable proposition, like to hire an architect versus a builder. And now we're talking about buildings that have lasted a long time versus buildings that haven't lasted a long time. A lot of those buildings that have lasted a long time were built by people who didn't have architecture degrees. They would put together, you know, mortar and brick and build something that was really permanent. And then you also have a lot of modern buildings that are shoddily built by people who call themselves architects who have the degree. And so I'm just, my question is just like, yeah, tell me what's an architecture degree? What does it give you versus somebody who's a builder?
It also makes a difference as, you know, your attitude going into it. Are you an architect as a designer? Or are you an architect as a builder? You know,
as an engineer? I mean, I love and hate that question equally. But that means it's a great question because, you know, there are people, as I said, who literally are just trying to make pretty things. And that's not what architecture is about. If you
it's
take
not
the function
just about the
out
design.
Of it,
that, yeah. And we talked about this in a previous program, which bears lots of discussion. You know, that architectural education in the United States really is based on the Beaux-Arts tradition in Paris, the École des Beaux-Arts. Because in the 1870s and 1880s, we really didn't have colleges of architecture. I think Cornell may have been the first. So late 19th century architects like Henry Hobson Richardson studied in Paris, and Hunt, who did the base for the, I'm tempted to say his first name was William Morris Hunt, but in any case, he studied also in Paris. And in the Paris Academy, in the 1870s and 80s, there were those who said, let architecture be the decorative aspect, and let everything else be an engineering study. And there was a heated debate. And one of the most interesting to me architects of that era, who was a whiz at structure, but also made his structural expressions extremely inventive, was Viollet-le-Duc, who I think was a contemporary, possibly, if we need to research this, of Gustave Eiffel, who did the engineering for the Eiffel Tower. And so you look at the Eiffel Tower, and though it is an engineering work, it is also with architectural intent, which is one of the interesting things about this Mies aphorism. Yeah. Architecture starts when you carefully put two bricks together.
Or God is in the details. I mean, yes. there's many stories.
How it's built.
Yeah, I mean, there's many stories. I'll give one illustrative story right now that has nothing to do with architecture and everything to do with architecture.
Okay.
Van Halen, band in the 80s, right?
Sure.
Before my time. They had, when they were in their prime... I was born in the 80s, but late 80s. Whatever. I'm young. I love it. So
you're a student of architecture. It's a given that you should be 19 or 20 at this point.
Fair enough. I've taken my time. I'm 21. Brian's 22, but we've had previous lives. But let's continue with this story. So Van Halen, in their prime, had 9 trucks of just stuff that they carted with them.
Is it gear?
gear and stage sets and everything that they carted with them from place to place. Now, there was something in their contract that said in every single place that they were going on these crazy world tours, there had to be a bowl of M&Ms in their dressing room with the brown M&Ms taken out. Now, you're laughing, but you know what? This had nothing to do with the band.
Or the music.
This was a brilliant contract writer. One of their lawyers, along with the contract writer, put that in the contract because the stage setup was so complex that they knew if they arrived at a place and there was not a bowl with all of the brown M&Ms taken out, chances are the people who were setting up this concert either made a huge mistake or even a life-threatening mistake. So that kind of illustrates how details are so important. And with people like Meese, he brought that into the forefront of things. And I think that they're ignoring that, at least where we go to school, unfortunately, for the most part. And we have to try to ally ourselves with the older professors because, you know, it really is kind of divided in half between older professors and guys who are basically in their late 20s or early 30s. So we really have to decide as students what we want to do.
Well, let me suggest to you that you make your own education. The education cannot be a received commodity. I went to a mediocre high school, and I got a great education because I found...
It's what you pursue.
I found the two or three good teachers, and I got the most I could out of them.
Absolutely.
In my case, I started studying architectural-related subjects when I was 14, almost like an apprenticeship. Back in the 20th century, they taught architectural drafting in high school. And so I learned how to draw. I knew how to draw up wall sections of houses before I graduated from high school. Now, that these days would be a vocational tech kind of notion, but this was a college prep program.
They advertise for that stuff on the subway now.
Oh, that's right. And so it was good for me to go to a school where they didn't let you design a building for the first year. It was really great to purge your mind from all of these accreted notions of what architecture is about. So I went from thinking that proper architectural design was something with a mansard roof to understanding the architectonics of space. Now, that was a received experience that I got going to Cooper Union. But over the years, as luck would have it, I was introduced more and more to work in the field and to see the people working in the crafts and trades. And I highly recommend that as an experience whenever you find yourself in an architectural practice. Insist that you want to be involved with construction administration and ask a lot of questions of the people doing the work. There's no such thing as a stupid question. They will love to tell you what they're doing. That's how I learned how things go together. You're not going to get that in school. And you do have to design your own education to a certain extent.
Agreed.
Enough for my opining. Let's take another little break, listen to some more current music, and come back.
Nice.
Power, need it.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Welcome back to Burning Down the House, a continuing conversation about the culture of architecture here on the Heritage Radio Network. Our guests today are
Eric Moen
and Brian Schulman.
Also in the studio is our guest interlocutor,
Jamie Waugh,
and Allison Wayne, just here for kicks because tomorrow's my birthday.
Whoa, happy birthday.
Right, thank you.
Party.
Our engineer is Jack Inslee. EJ Dukoski is our producer. So we're in the middle of just having a conversation about architectural education, especially as received by these two fine young men at the Pratt Institute here in beautiful Brooklyn.
It's beautiful.
And you had, something you had to say during the break, which I hope that you can remember what that was.
Yeah, actually.
Well, you started with craft and builders and builders versus architects. And I tried to derail that by bringing up the École des Beaux-Arts because that's a showstopper. But
it's fun to say, too.
It is.
Yeah. It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, yeah.
But look, I mean, the very best architects have always been masters of the craft of building. Charles Eames is my man, and his house and his contemporaries with the California case study houses, which were almost a challenge that Esther McCoy, who was an architectural editor, opposed to these young Turk designers after World War II to design a modern house from a kit of parts. And they did so. John Entenza and Eames and guy who died a couple of years ago who had the cantilevered house.
Neutra?
Not Neutra, but...
Schindler?
Not Schindler. Another young... You've seen this house. It's iconographic. It's all glass, and there's just one plane that hangs over the edge of the cliff, and all... it's
one like from
where
Eric
was this?
That house was in Illinois.
It's for sale now, you know that?
Whatever.
There's one photographed by Schulman, I think.
Yeah.
He passed recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know what?
But anyway, so these people actually spent the time to educate themselves as to how steel goes together. And they made the bolts decorative. And they made the houses airy and light and beautiful and cheap.
But now, that was the new technology at the time. Now the technology is the computer. Fortunately or unfortunately, it's up in the air.
I don't think fabrication has caught up to the wild fantasies that these people are cooking
up. Well, let's talk about these polymorphic fantasies.
Getting close.
I mean, you can do almost anything with a wire mesh armature and spray polyurethane foam if you want to live in domes. What do you think about that?
Well,
does that interest you?
Not at all.
We haven't really gotten into your deep thing.
So we were just discussing during the break that there's a big divide in Pratt, or I'm sure in many architecture schools, where there's the scripting movement, where you basically plug the numbers into the computer and it spits out a wonderful, beautiful pattern that you can call a building if you want.
How's that different from an Etch-a-Sketch?
That's a great question.
Or a Spirograph, okay?
True, yeah.
I mean, you put the dials together and do the pen, and then you have some sort of riff on a Fibonacci series.
Absolutely.
But is that architecture?
No, you know what? I'll tell you one of the most brilliant things I've seen up on the walls between all the pinups and everything.
Yes.
Is there's this one person, we don't know who it is, plasters up this thing, which is a syringe that says program in it, and a guy pushing it into a section of a building, injecting program, because that's what people do. They make these forms and they quote unquote inject the program into it afterwards.
So I have a question though. Aren't architects kind of shooting themselves in the foot in terms of the legitimacy of their profession?
Absolutely.
So what do you do? What's the answer to that? Come on, you guys are.
We got to work with builders. We got to build things ourselves. You have to start small and work our way up.
Well, that was part of the regime at the Taliesin Institute in Scottsdale, is you had to build your own structure.
Right, and there are still studios, I mean, at Pratt and I'm sure other schools where you do build things as the design project.
I know.
Not just building models.
Columbia for the master's program.
Sure.
One of my friends just finished her master's at Columbia, and that was a project that they did. It was a contest, and they ended up winning it.
What did they build?
Structure. It was some kind of I don't know, habitational thing.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check.
There's a good start.
Like, I don't know, yeah. I mean, I don't pay that much attention.
Well, listen, you know what?
One of the things that I would love to do, I mean, and we could organize this as a field trip. I would like to take a group of architectural students or young graduates on a trip through Home Depot. Yeah, because, I mean, a good one. I don't mean the ones
that we've had many, many trips there.
And you discover all sorts of things that you never knew existed. Tools that you didn't know that existed that you would never see. Even I, who has been on perhaps 400 construction sites over the last 15 years, only see some of these tools once or twice in a lifetime. You know, like a bush hog. You know what a bush hog is?
What does it do?
It's a 5-horsepower electric motor-driven drill. And the haft of the drill bit is a good 3/4 inch in diameter. And you could bore your way through feet of concrete if you needed to make big holes in preparation for chopping away at concrete.
But see, the problem is that many people, you'd be boring through their minds by talking about it. And that is why students don't want to learn about this stuff.
Well, I think that's a problem that's endemic in the culture at large. People live in their heads. They don't live in the real world.
Is that just in the States, or is that other countries' educations too?
I can't speak for any other countries, unfortunately, but I do think that it is definitely sweeping across the world at this point. But to certain countries' defense, like if you look at Asia now, I mean, they're actually building some of the stuff that they come up with on the computer there. Whether it's good or not is another story.
That has to do with their fabrication capabilities.
Well, it's all made there anyway, you know?
It's true.
But that technology came from here anyway. Uh-huh. It's just...
Yeah, but they manufacture it there. When Meese was practicing, they manufactured things here in America.
Steel.
That's a whole big issue that we should talk about some other time. That these days, if you need structural steel, it's either coming from Japan or Europe. Mm-hmm. You don't want Chinese steel. Do you know why you don't want Chinese? This is one of my, you know, cause celebs. You've only had 2 years of architecture school, so you've probably only had 1 year of structural engineering, correct?
Hardly.
All right. Structural steel needs to be what's called new billet steel. It means it had to come directly from iron ore that came out of a mine. The Chinese, as we know, have a problem with quality control. And they are making steel, but they're making steel out of junked car parts, railroad rails, stuff that's left over from cans, and that's a problem because the American Institute of Steel Construction, the people who publish the standards, require it to be new billet so that we know what actually the provenance of the materials is. Yeah,
sounds sustainable though.
I think it's the same thing. Is there a way to test that? It is sustainable. You are using recycled parts. I mean, can you not give a compression test?
You could use those materials
smaller projects
for something else. No, you could use it for siding. Steel roofing, non-structural applications.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can test it, but you don't know what other trace elements might be in the steel and what effects it may have on its strength. Mm-hmm. That might change over time, however. It's always a possibility that in your lifetimes, So 2060. In 2060, we may have new rules.
If the world doesn't end in 2012, that is.
Yeah, if the Mayans' calendar having expired doesn't somehow mystically cause the sun to explode. Yeah, okay. I'm really looking forward to that.
So talking about builders and, you know, people who are actually draftsmen and, you know, people who know what they're doing and people who don't know what they're doing in terms of their hands and building... we were talking about Calatrava earlier, and the fact mm-hmm. that, you know, he built a pretty interesting bridge that doesn't seem to actually sustain the weight that it's supposed to sustain. Namely,
yeah, I should
namely
be careful before you go, you know, doing hatchet jobs on people we might want to come by and talk to us.
Well, I love you. We love you, Santiago. Yeah. You're the best.
But his building in Chicago, you know, what about, let's talk about his needle in Chicago. How, you know, what do you think about that, you know, drawing and the structure? And
I mean, architecture is, it's a human activity. It's not being designed by robots, or at least we'd hope not. So it is liable to sort of mistakes, but it's also liable to those beautiful moments that only
humans can come up with. Yeah,
human and a builder can make, as opposed to plugging it into a computer.
What do you think Louis Sullivan would think of the Calatrava building? You know, Louis Sullivan's buildings all over downtown Chicago in the Loop. I mean, they're buddies now. They're going to be next to each other. What do you think Sullivan would think of that?
I think he would be disgusted. But that's not a reflection on Mr. Calatrava at all. Yeah. I mean, he's done a needle before to put the world at ease here. I'm sure the one in Chicago is going to be just great. He's done one before, and it's in Barcelona. So I think he's experienced in that. The bridges, on the other hand, we'll see what happens.
But it's just a needle. I mean, there are many, many, many ways of making a tall building.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the Woolworth building is a fairly tall building, and it has a certain grace. You may not like the Gothic expression of ornament, but it has mm-hmm. a mass that is pleasing, and it also has coloration that's pleasing. You know, it's a white tower. Many, many new buildings in New York are dark, or they're gray, or they're, you know, very dark brick.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure. Well, what does that mean to you? How do you respond to some of these color choices?
Color choices. I mean, we're going through that right now because Brian and I actually are working on our first built work. Even mm-hmm. though we are still students, we luckily have gotten a project in Brooklyn on Myrtle Avenue, where we're designing a student center / art gallery. And Brian, I'm sure like you would love to regale everyone with our material choices.
All about the materials.
Good.
How you? I mean, especially in a space like that where people are really touching things and moving things.
Well, what colors do you like?
Well, we're architects, so a tempting answer would be to say black. But my favorite color is gray.
But really? Most of the stuff in that space.
But what about chromatic expression? No yellows,
red.
No greens.
Well,
something
powerful, exciting.
It's an art gallery, so you know, competing with the art would not be a very good idea. But most of it's going to be white.
Yeah,
just for
well,
the record,
it's a gallery. But exactly. Then there are galleries at the Met that are green, red, gray.
This isn't the Met.
Blue.
I mean, we're not even trying to be the
Met. Well, you know that the program at the Bauhaus included painting as an expression of painting walls. I mean, that whole idea goes back to Joseph Albers' paintings, because he was the painting master there. And when they built various structures for the Bauhaus, they didn't decorate the cornices. They didn't even have bases at where the wall met the floor. It just had planes of color.
Well, Stephen Hole would definitely be an architect who thinks that color is, you know, equally as important as material and how the space is moved, because it's just another sense. It's being seen by your eyeballs.
I can't fault that. I think color is perhaps the most challenging
mm-hmm.
choice.
It is very challenging.
You can be presented
with. How about
with.
This proposal? What about scents? What
scent?
About the smell of a room? I don't think that is a sense that's
well,
been...
Well, if we... Here in the studio, in the shipping containers...
Can you design the smell of a room?
You know, if we sanded down some of this wood, it would probably...
Very rustic.
Heighten our sense of
being
happiness
in a shed,
to smell the sawdust.
I felt like that when I walked in here.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, like I was. It smelled like a cedar sauna. And
yeah, I feel very manly
I've never
right
been
now.
In one, but...
Definitely.
Well, it is definitely sauna-like.
Well, obviously.
Jack, can we take a 3-minute break, turn on the AC? Thank you.
But it's not that easy. Standing in the light field, standing in the light field, waiting for some action, waiting for some action. Oh, but why won't you come over here? Why won't you come over here? Standing in the light field, standing in the light field, waiting for some actress, waiting for some actress to say, why won't you come over here? Why won't you come over here?
All right, what was that?
That was the Strokes.
The Strokes.
When I think of New York Strokes, City. I think of New York City and I think of precision because they have these dueling guitars, which sounds kind of like 80s hair rock kind of deal, but not quite like that. Dueling guitars, very precisely thought out. Julian Casablancas.
Well, you know, in my day, there was no such thing as personal music. There was a radio in a studio with 150 people.
And well, that's the way
no iPods.
Be. No, it should be that. And you know what? They should be playing Brian and I's show on it. They should just be streaming it.
They should just be playing our radio show.
Yeah.
Give yourself a plug.
Okay, we'll do that. Our
show is called Urban Grilling.
That's right, Urban Grilling. It's on Pratt Radio. You can look it up on iTunes, and we have a website.
Facebook. Skype
yeah.
it.
Yeah, whatever.
MySpace, I don't know.
Do it.
Whatever.
Just do it.
Google it. Okay. But yeah, that's our radio show, and
we play a lot of music.
Yes. But what you were saying, if there was a... There is that issue in the studio, and people like to blast their own music,
God.
And it causes riots, literally.
Really?
Causes a lot of animosity among the students.
Well, that's a problem with having too much choice.
Yeah, it is. And it's also, as you can imagine, the people who are blasting the music don't necessarily have the most tact when it comes to their musical taste. So it's kind of an issue.
If you like
hearing drum and bass all day, then you'll be in heaven. But, you know.
Although, there's an exception to that. There's a really good exception to that. I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is sort of known as kind of an eccentric community. And there's a guy who every weekend when it's sunny out, Saturdays and Sundays, he must be in his 50s or something, and he has like this Subaru station wagon. And he drives around the city in his Subaru with the windows down, blaring 60s tunes, like Sonny and Cher.
Okay.
It's music that, you know, you can't not like, really. Mm-hmm. Kind of just dorky 60s music.
Mm-hmm.
And he sings along louder than the radio all day Saturday and all day Sunday.
Awesome.
Everyone waves at him.
On the way home, I live in Flatbush, so I drive from Fort Greene to Flatbush. And I roll through in a very urban neighborhood, but I like to blast the Beastie Boys and sing along.
Represent.
Beastie Boys should be blasted.
Yeah.
Always.
So we really haven't found out what really is, you know, like what you're... I will confess that when I was your age, I was challenged, tempted, seduced, and totally at a loss how to achieve the kind of simplicity that I saw in post-war Scandinavian houses where the woodwork was perfect and the proportions were exquisite. And I'm still struggling with that 40 years later. So do you have any sort of...
We're still looking for...
You're looking for your
but
passion.
But that search is the thing itself, that...
The thing in of itself.
Just keeping your eyes open and looking and understanding and trying to learn about everything and...
Well, there's everything to learn because architecture embraces every physical act that humans undertake.
Well, that's why I think people actually, speaking of which, ignore the psychological aspects of how you make can affect people, number one. And number two, in terms of your initial question, I really think that, as Brian was saying, as students, I mean, let's be frank here, we've done 2 years of architecture school. So
we got three to go.
We got three to go. We're right in the middle here. And I'll speak for myself when I say that I have allied myself with professors who are probably in their 70s and 80s who I felt, would really introduce me to not only what architecture is, but how it relates to philosophy, how it relates to materials, and really just the details.
And how's that working out for you?
I've enjoyed it immensely. I mean, I'm actually taking notes in class. I'm doing well. I'm getting along with these dudes who have attitudes. Yeah. It's great.
They're old school, but a lot of fun. But I mean, I was saying at the same time, it's also fun
What in your mind is old school?
I don't know.
if you haven't used a computer for anything other than email,
I mean, that too has put us at an advantage.
And
in
I
our
have
generation
to tell you, in my own experience. I had my own firm, Wayne Architects, in Greenwich, Connecticut from 1992 through 2001. And it was 100% 2D, 3D, CAD, studio the entire time. Extremely high resolution modeling. Mm-hmm. So I could just send my drawings off and they would fabricate from my 3D model. I don't use the computer anymore these years later. Because I prefer, one, to look at hard copy, two, freehand sketching,
yes,
to scale for working out details. Well, I don't know what it was. It's like I'm in the post-computer era now.
I get it. I mean, it's amazing, though, to see that Brian and I are basically the only ones with a sketchbook in our studios a lot. It's
well, that's a crime. It's a crime against architecture.
Oh, wow.
I think we've come to the end of our time.
Everything's cyclical, guys. Everything's cyclical.
I think I'll have you come back. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This has been Burning Down the House, about the culture of architecture here on the Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Done.